Good afternoon. The Secondary Education and Career Development Subcommittee will now come to order. Missy, would you call the roll for us, please?
Chair McLean.
Here.
Vice Chair Shove.
Here.
Ranking Member Bush.
Here.
Representative Andrade.
Here.
Representative Benjamin.
Here.
Representative Barrero.
Here.
Representative Fisher.
Here.
Representative Gio Lombardo.
Here.
Representative Harding.
Here.
Representative Maggard.
Here.
Representative Maney.
Here.
Representative Omfroy.
Here.
Representative Rizzo. Representative Robinson.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Valdez.
Present.
Representative Woodson.
Here.
Representative Yarborough.
Here. Thank you. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Please make sure you, everyone's turned off their electronic devices. And if you have a question to ask, please be recognized by the chair. That'd be for committees and presenters as well. And remember that the green light does not mean that your mic is hot. You have to push the button to make it hot. Members, welcome back. Last week, we heard about the importance of identifying a unified list of high-value credentials that lead individuals to economic and career success. This includes non-degree credentials such as industry certifications, certificates, apprenticeship certifications, and licenses. It also includes degree credentials such as associates and bachelor's in science degrees. We also learned about the critical role accurate and reliable data plays in tracking outcomes. Today, we will look at ways to prioritize, incentivize, and promote the attainment of high-value credentials. Without clear incentives for attainment of high-value credentials, students and institutions may not prioritize pursuit of these credentials. A need exists for deploying a wide range of incentives to motivate students to earn those credentials and institutions to offer them. We have three presentations this afternoon. Presenters' typical meeting protocol requires recognition by the chair before addressing the committee. However, in order to foster a more responsive discussion in this virtual environment, I will ask that you respond directly to member questions without first being recognized by the chair. Our first presentation this afternoon will be by Quentin Suffren, Senior Advisor of Innovative Policy at Excellence in Education. Mr. Suffren will discuss where credentials of value sit along the continuum of education to workforce policies. Mr. Suffren, you are recognized to make your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate the invitation to speak with you. I'll share my screen. So just as you mentioned, we are have a unique opportunity, I think, today, and also just kind of looking ahead at ways that states in Florida in particular can maximize its credential attainment, and particularly in those areas where there are the highest needs or highest growth areas. And so today, since I'm first up, I'm going to spend my time kind of providing a little bit of framing for this conversation by really thinking about industry credentials, the incentives that are available to actually promote attainment of those credentials and supports for learners along the way, sit across kind of a longer continuum of policies that make up a strong education to workforce system. And of course, we're talking about pathways for learners, supports for access, affordability, equity, and also making sure that, to your earlier point, that the credentials that are being promoted, incentivized, and attained are those that have value in the labor market, and also are those that are going to be able to lift learners either out of poverty or make them more economically mobile and prosperous. We know that looking out at states, and I know the other Kathleen and Chancellor Reeser will focus in on specific ways of doing this, but we do know that incentivizing credentials is part of a broader set of policies, and oftentimes they require kind of coordination and integration to make sure that what you're incentivizing is exactly what you want. So I'm going to take just a moment to step back and look at kind of where industry credentials sit along the broader continuum of policies. And I think the best place to start is recognizing, especially now with the pandemic and what it's done to a lot of state economies, and upending the lives and livelihoods of many citizens, is to really kind of think about who are we serving, those learners. And I think more than ever, we're seeing that those learner journeys that folks are taking are different. And this graphic, which has been shared with you, is just a way to kind of convey both the learners that we're serving, the stakeholders involved, and then finally, kind of what are the policies that can be worked in tandem with credentialing to make sure that these programs are really having the impact that you desire. And so I'll boil it down very quickly. There are, you know, lots of different learners, their journeys are different. We've chosen to represent three here. But I think one, the top is a learner called Alex, and she is fast tracking her way to a bachelor's degree, leveraging policies such as college acceleration, college articulation agreements, and in this case, an internship where she can then, you know, continue her route into employment. And along the way, that allows her to kind of remove barriers of access. But we know that a lot of learners are not taking that linear path to and through K-12 into university or college and onto a bachelor's. In reality, we have also learners like Jordan and Taylor. Jordan, who is earning her way through this education to workforce pathway by leveraging credentials. In first case, an industry credential in IT, then a registered apprenticeship program, taking advantage of the kind of stackable credentials that the state may have articulated or shown to be valuable and then promoted onto the workforce as a kind of a stepping stone pathway. And then finally, I think our last learner that I think we're, you know, all concerned about now is someone like Taylor, who has lost his job. In this case, it's due to automation. You could say it's due to a lot of factors now, but finding himself out of a job that has been, you know, now made obsolete, what is his pathway to go back and really rethink what his occupational opportunities are and the best way to get that, to pursue that pathway? And in doing that, the policies that are really critical here are those skills retraining and credentialing, a last mile scholarship, allowing him to complete a degree when he's very close to earning it. And that removes those barriers of automation and lack of tuition. Obviously, underneath all of these learners are a host of stakeholders working together, really to try to create those partnerships, those opportunities, strengthen those programs, and more important, and most importantly, setting the vision for what these programs ought to do and providing the supports and funding and promotion to make sure that folks know that they are available and out there. And then finally, when you think about kind of undergirding all of this, is a set of policies, which we tried to map at least what we are seeing in states. And it boiled down to, when we think about a continuum of education to workforce pathways, there are really six key focus areas. And we identified 20 key policies. We could have probably added a couple more, taken one away. But we went kind of looking and seeing kind of what are the most common things that we're seeing in promoting and achieving success. And so you can see those six focus areas, those learner pathways, things like high quality CTE, targeted funding, an audit of your CTE programs to post-secondary acceleration and attainment, looking at those stackable credentials, the different sorts of policies around articulation agreements that are going to be critical so that as folks get credentials, they are actually earning college credit at the same time. On to the other side of the continuum where you have really the workforce readiness and that critical notion of employer engagement and involving them in these conversations and priority setting exercises early on. And then finally, on the far right is really kind of how you know whether or not these things are working, right? What are the shared indicators? What are the data systems going to need to connect, collect, and use? In order to help inform these programs, their progress, and how well you can be supporting them. So there are 20 policies. I'm not going to spend time to go all through them, but if you think about it, we have credentials here a couple of times, stackable credentials really focused on that, those academic credentials, which include degrees, certificates, other things, and also the non-degree industry credentials that you mentioned earlier. But what we are finding before I leave this is that oftentimes when you are pulling one of these levers, you often have to pull one or two others along the continuum to make sure that it's working. For example, if you think about incentives for industry engagement and employers that typically comes along with some of those stackable credential opportunities, work-based learning or apprenticeships. And they're all woven together depending on how states choose to approach it. So I put this out here before we talk about a couple examples of incentives and how they can work, and also how they can be strengthened in some cases, because there are cautions to incentives as well. So I'm going to switch back over very quickly. And I want to highlight an example of one state program. There are several of them. I think Kathleen's going to talk about a couple, and I know Chancellor Reeser with TSTC is going to talk about a whole model devoted to kind of looking at the different outcomes. But one that we've found that is pretty innovative is also in Indiana. It's a Next Level Jobs program, and it is focused on credential attainment. So they have identified stackable credentials in 6 high growth fields. These are based on demand, wage earnings, job placement, et cetera. And they have 2 grant programs that are available. One for learners, any learner 18 or older, and it's gonna pay a last dollar financial aid to basically cover the cost of that program that they choose. It provides coaching, and it includes all the 2-year and 4-year colleges as providers. And so just as it's incentivizing learners to go back and earn a credential, it's incentivizing those post-secondary institutions to offer what is deemed as the most valuable credentials of value in terms of outcomes for the state's economy. At the same time, this works hand in hand with not just thinking about the learners who are kind of going through or trying to seek a path into post-secondary or the workforce. It also focuses on employers and those existing employees, where it provides employers an incentive of up to $5,000 per learner with a cap of $50,000 for each employee who is trained, hired, or retrained and retained for 6 months. And so in that case, this could be an existing worker that they said, look, we need you to get this new certification or this new credential, and here's a program that we're going to be involved in helping train you to do that. And so it really focuses not just on the education side of things, but also on the workforce side of things, and thinking about who can train, who can be involved in these programs, and which learners we're targeting, so that someone like Taylor, his job does not become obsolete because they've upskilled him in the process. And I say all this not to say that this is a program everybody should emulate. It is one that I highlight only because it does really look at not just incentivizing credentials, but the broader policies that are out there and that have to work together, such as those shared priorities, last dollar financial aid, yes, the stackable credentials and retraining, and also the incentives for employers. So this is a multi-pronged policy effort. And that's in part, you know, to say, yes, it's comprehensive. But the other thing that I would argue is that it's also to make sure that there are multiple leverage points for making sure that the outcomes you're incentivizing at different places actually give you the results that you want. I'll show you one that I think the state is ripe to really support here, and that is Florida's CAPE industry certification incentives. You currently have really one of the most successful incentive programs in the nation for K-12 and to your schools here. In 2018 and 19 alone, Florida secondary learners earned almost 200,000 industry credentials. That includes some of the digital tools and the other pieces, but that's a huge number, and you're seeing a lot of attainment numbers, you know, kind of grow over the course of time. The only downside here is that this is a policy that's focused on kind of one piece, incentives alone. And so what that means is that you get a lot of credentials being earned that are either at just the one-off course level, so an Adobe or productivity skill suite, rather than credentials that are associated kind of with a longer term pathway, such as a diesel technician, or I mean a diesel mechanic or a technician, or someone in a cybersecurity pathway. So you're seeing a lot of credential attainment. It just might not be what it is that you're hoping in terms of being aligned to a high skill, high wage, high demand occupation. And part of this is because there is a missing component here, which is all the incentives is on credentials, and that leaves no targeted funding for CTE and targeted incentives for high-quality CTE programs of study. Right now, Florida funds its CTE courses at the same level it funds its high school courses. And I'm not advocating for mass funding increases or anything like that at all. I'm just saying that when you do that, you have only so many leverage points that you can push on. And so as a result, you have a lot of students earning certifications. Some of those may not actually be the most valued by employers. In many cases, the students are earning certifications in large numbers, in greater numbers than employers are even asking for. And second, schools are incentivized really to pursue the attainment by volume. So they're going after Adobe Photoshop or Suite, the certified associate or the Microsoft credentials, because they aren't pathway credentials. They can be given in a course and they can generate a lot of revenue. In many cases, these are not districts that aren't doing good work. They're having to leverage funds from their credential attainment incentives to actually fund broader pathways. And as a result, you see that in outcomes. Florida has a very low rate of CTE concentrators. Those are folks who take multiple courses, and also pathway completion. And so as you think about the kinds of incentives that you would want to entertain to really focus on, yes, credentials of value, it's critical to remember that these credentials are provided in a pathway. They're not something that exists on their own. So thinking about that broader pathway, those broader policies is something that I think we have seen is of growing importance. And I think I'll leave you with kind of a sense of kind of, throughout the pandemic, we've all been shopping online, and it feels like every time you check out in your cart, they have this kind of other items they want you to buy, and they're frequently bought together items. And that's kind of how we're thinking about this approach to really thinking about how best to incentivize credential attainment, how best to understand and promote and offer credentials of value, is that when you consider the different questions or the different criteria that you want to lay out for programs such as this, whether it's then you have to consider things like the different learner pathways that are going to support them. Who's going to need the most support to be successful? What other skills or experiences, such as work-based learning, on the job training, apprenticeship programs, or youth apprenticeships, are they going to need to be wrapped around these credentials? And finally, consider what other supports are needed to offset implementation challenges. So that if you're incentivizing one outcome, you might need to incentivize two or three other outcomes to make sure that they're all actually working together. And so I've laid out here just some examples of how these policies can be frequently bought together as you kind of chart your course. As we know that Florida has set the goal of becoming number one in the nation for credential attainment. And I think that there's a strong foundation in Florida for doing that. And certainly thinking about this across that continuum, I think it's exciting to see how you'll move forward. And I know that Kathleen and Chancellor Reeser will have more to share in terms of some of the specifics about how you might do that.
Thank you, Mr. Suffren, for that presentation. Members, do you have any questions for Mr. Suffren? Representative Yarborough.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Suffren, for the presentation. I know you didn't pull it up on the screen, but there's a sheet that's included in the presentation that talks about the credential matters summary, I think it's called. And one of those indicates that, or doesn't indicate rather, that the state develops approved credential lists collaboratively with employers and industry. And I was just wondering, number one, how did you arrive at the conclusion? And two, are there specific industries that may not have been looked at or sought after for their input in that regard? If you could answer that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Thank you for the question, Representative. And I will say that we did not make that value judgment when we did the collection for all of the Credentials Matter kind of information around the states. We did it through a survey, and folks at the state, depending on the right agency, were kind enough to provide that information to us. I do think there are a couple different processes that that are in place, whether it's the K-12 industry certification list or the post-secondary. But we did not set out to make that as a value judgment on our own.
Are there any other questions, members? All right. Mr. Suffren, thank you for that presentation this afternoon. We appreciate it. We'll be moving on to our second presenter, who is Ms. Kathleen Mathers, principal at the Education Strategy Group. Ms. Mathers will discuss incentives that states can establish to increase attainment of credentials of value and common barriers to credential attainment. Ms. Mathers, you're recognized to make your presentation.
Thank you. Just do a quick audio check. I hope everyone can hear me. My name is Kathleen Mathers. I'm a principal at Education Strategy Group, or ESG. I lead our career readiness work, and it's my pleasure to be with you this afternoon. ESG as an organization focuses on strengthening the intersections between education and training systems and the world of work so that we can help more learners earn credentials that have currency in today's labor market. So my remarks will be sort of from that vein. One of the ways that we do this is by helping states and communities understand and harness sort of the power, the quality, the value of all credentials, certainly, but especially non-degree credentials as well, which, as you pointed out a little earlier, can include industry recognized credentials, apprenticeship licenses, state licenses, a range of things that lead to good jobs that are more than a high school diploma, but less than a bachelor's degree. Some of our non-degree credential work is in partnership with the National Skills Coalition. So I'll try to tag my remarks to those that you heard from my colleague, Amy Ellen Duke Benfield, last week. And so you'll see some alignment there. But as this slide shows, ESG's non-degree credential policy focuses on sort of these three buckets of priorities. Number one, at the top of the list here, is identify which credentials from the thousands that are available in the marketplace have clear employment value. Some have absolutely clear value, others not so much. So how can we kind of work through that process to understand which fall into each bucket? The second then is, once you've identified those and you understand which have value, how can you put policy incentives in place that will help more learners earn those credentials? And then the third piece there is on collect and report credential attainment data. So how can we do a better job at collecting information to understand which credentials are being earned and by whom? Right now, that information is deficient across most states because it exists in a number of different places. So we focus on strengthening those pieces as well. We've developed a toolkit at ESG, and you'll see this kind of broken down on your screen, and you'll have access to these slides afterwards as well. This toolkit is freely available to all states, and it offers sort of a sample step-by-step process that states can work through to identify and incentivize and report on attainment of these non-degree credentials. So we emphasize the importance of bringing all of our sectors together, K-12, higher education, workforce development, so that together we're sending really clear signals to learners about the credentials that are going to make the biggest difference in their lives. You can see from this chart that we kind of break it down into four steps. The first is using labor market information to identify non-degree credentials that lead to in-demand, family-sustaining wage jobs. So putting that right at the top of the value chart. There's a lot of jobs available, and they pay a good wage such that a learner can support a family. The second piece there that you'll see in orange is bringing the employer community in to validate that information. It's great to look at the labor market information to see what's showing in job ads in terms of credentials that people rely on in their hiring processes. But we also need to convene employers from across our states to say, are these the right credentials? Do you in fact value them when you are hiring and promoting your workers? Are there some that are missing here? So that second piece is critically important. The third piece then is going into those policy incentives that can drive attainment of those high degree credentials and de-emphasize credentials that don't meet your value indicators. Need to be careful that we're not sending our learners down dead-end paths. And then the fourth is, again, publicly reporting on our non-degree credentials in particular, getting a better feel of how successful we are. with students earning those different pieces. So defining and identifying priority credentials is complex. It's not an easy thing to go through. So we try to get really focused on what it means to have quality and value within credentials. And these three points kind of illustrate the top pieces or the top priorities. Number one, that those high value credentials represent acquired knowledge and skills that are needed in good jobs. Number two, that they lead to jobs that are plentiful and pay a family sustaining wage. And number three, that they set learners up for continued education and training. ESG has just recently started a project with Florida that will take us the better part of the year to complete. But it's exactly this process of helping Florida define what we mean by high value credentials and identify those that meet those value indicators. So we'll work with the Florida Department of Education to convene a number of stakeholders through a work group to help build a consensus definition, get everyone on the same page across our sectors, across our industry. What does it mean to have value? We'll then develop a corresponding methodology to go with this. So to your question a little bit earlier about the extent to which we bring the employer community in and we ask if particular credentials have value, that will all be part of this process, that we comb through the labor market information, we understand what the job ads are telling us, and then we talk with employers through surveys, through focus groups, to make sure that we're prioritizing the credentials that will make a difference in learners' lives. We'll also use this process to then identify, are there new strategies or new priorities that perhaps would require legislation or new policy? So want to make sure you all are aware of this since it could potentially involve legislation. And also note how this process and the things that we learn along the way could inform changes in the annual CTE audit that you do in Florida. So it's a pretty robust body of work that all starts with identifying those credentials. From there, we'll get into what you all are especially interested in today, which is policy incentives. So we know which credentials have the greatest value, where we want to make sure more people are earning those credentials. So I'd say that these incentives generally fall into three buckets, and I won't read all of these to you, but generally we see across states there are financial incentives that can be put into place, accountability incentives, and communication incentives. In Florida, as Quentin noted, you're already doing a number of these things. You are offering additional funding to schools and districts for students that earn credentials on the CAPE list. Those CAPE credentials articulate for post-secondary credit. So your high school students who are earning those credentials are already acquiring those post-secondary credits before they move into their post-secondary space. Gives them a step ahead and an accelerated pathway. And you're communicating the value of those credentials very intentionally to students and families to make sure they're aware of the opportunity and what it could mean for their lives and their futures. So you're already doing some of these things. Perhaps some of the others on these lists will give you some additional ideas, but I did want to focus in on financial incentive number three, which is where I understand you have a special interest in learning a little bit more about what's already happening across our country. So moving to an outcomes-based funding model. And there are two that I'll spend a little bit of time talking about. I'll go pretty high level on these, and hopefully it'll give you a pretty good feel for these. Those programs are in Virginia and in Ohio. We'll start here with Virginia. Virginia's program is called the Fast Forward Program. It is an outcomes-based funding model. It's a non-credit workforce training program that leads to industry credentials and certifications. It's been very successful, and it helps primarily non-traditional learners. The average age of the person in this program, completing this program, is about 36, and it's overwhelmingly male compared to female. So just some distinguishing characteristics. The Fast Forward program, as you can see in this first field here, is based on the 40 highest demand fields in Virginia. Virginia noted several years ago, they had a number of workforce openings that were going unfilled. And so they were trying to match learners to those opportunities. So they do look very closely at the highest demand fields. I'll note that wage is not considered here. And I would just plant that as a flag for you all to consider. if I have, as a job seeker, I'm trying to figure out what I want to study, what do I want to earn so that I can get a job, wage is certainly going to play into my thinking and something that we think you should really take into consideration when talking about value. But Virginia's program focuses on the 40 highest demand fields. They have an over 90% completion rate, and it generally takes only about 6 to 12 weeks to get through one of these programs. The enabling legislation required that this program be highly accessible to learners all across the state, so it is housed in their community college system to which learners across the state have access, and they include career coaching along the way so that especially for those who have been displaced from employment, who are trying to figure out what are their next steps, how do they move into higher value employment opportunities, there's some coaching in place that can help them think about their interests, their aptitudes, and what they might study next in order to find that job. It is an outcomes-based funding model. And so let me spend just a minute talking about that. You see two graphs here, and I'd like to focus your attention on scenario one on the left. So that the way the outcomes-based funding works in Virginia is that the eligible student covers one third of the cost upfront. There is financial aid that is available. And generally, this is several hundred dollars that someone has to spend in order to enroll in a program. So the learner pays that first one third. The state is going to cover the remaining two thirds of the cost, but they've designed it in a way that they've built sort of accountability into the model. So when the student completes the workforce training program, the state gives one third of the remaining funding to the community college. When the student earns the corresponding credential that goes alongside that program, the state gives the remaining one third of the funding to the community college. That's how it generally works. Over 90% of learners are completing their programs, and so far and away, this is the model in place. In the event that a learner does not complete the course and earn the credential, then the remaining two-thirds of cost is split between the learner and the community college. So there's accountability on both ends there. So number one, the learner has to pay an additional one-third to the state, and they do have some mechanisms in place to kind of offset the difficulty of doing that. They're pretty thoughtful about that piece. The community college, on the other hand, has to absorb the remaining one-third cost. And that's, again, in the event that the learner does not complete the program. So that's one program that's in place in Virginia. There's a second program that I'll just spend a moment talking about in Ohio within Ohio's technical centers. Several years ago, they moved to a performance-based funding program. It was part of a broader effort across their post-secondary institutions writ large to move into a performance-based funding program. Ohio's technical centers are very similar to the technical centers in Florida that are run by your school systems. They are accredited post-secondary institution that offer non-degree credentials that are workforce related. So there's some similarity here. Their performance-based funding formula takes four different indicators into consideration. Those are in red here. So retention, completion, certification, and job placement. 20% of the funding for technical centers is based on the number of students, full-time students, who complete at least half of a workforce training program. 25% is based on the number of students who actually complete their workforce training program. 5% of funding is based on students who earn an industry-recognized credential that's associated with their program. And the reason that percentage is pretty low is because not all of their programs have credentials. So going back to that value conversation, if there's not a high value credential that's associated with a job field, we don't want to put a low value credential there because then, to Quentin's point, we're incentivizing the wrong things. We're potentially sending someone down a dead end path. So they de-emphasize that in this particular funding model. And then if you look at number four, 50% of their funding is based on job placement. So after this program, did a learner get a job? Did he or she join the military? Did they enroll in additional education or training? All of those things count towards, yes, you get credit for that learner having moved forward in his or her life. The trick with the job placement piece is they can't measure exactly whether learners found a job in exactly the field that they trained in. So that's a little bit difficult to do, and it's a difficult thing for many states to do. So I would just point that out. The other thing that I would point out about Ohio's model is that they did phase this in over time because they wanted to avoid a precipitous drop in funding as they move from traditional to performance-based funding. So for example, you can see in my note here, in the first year, they made sure that no center would receive less than 96% of the average of its three-year funding, the previous 3 years funding level. And then over time, they tapered that percentage down until it gradually gets to zero, and these centers will be entirely based on performance-based funding. So there's Ohio. Lastly, just wanted to speak for a minute about barriers to credential attainment. So we put all of these incentives in place. We make clear which credentials make a difference to their lives. Here are some policy incentives to make it work. What then gets in the way of credential attainment? Certainly, this is not an exhaustive list, but there are four sort of main categories that I would highlight for your consideration. Number one, cost. A lot of folks are, you know, they're working part-time jobs. They're trying to support families. Money out of pocket matters. And there's an opportunity cost there that's really difficult for them to manage. The second is job offers. Especially in some of these high demand fields, employers will pluck folks out of their programs before learners complete the program. So welding, for example, may say to someone who's halfway through a program, you've learned enough. I can train you the rest of the way. Come on out of that program, get a good job, start making some money. And so you see folks leaving programs before they complete and earn their credential. Hopefully they continue that credentialing with employer, but not always. The third bucket being a lack of understanding about the employment value of particular credentials. A lot of folks just don't know what value a particular credential offers and how it can help them really move forward, how it can push economic and social mobility. And then the fourth bucket there being a lack of access, and why Virginia and Ohio put these programs into centers and institutions that have a strong footprint across the state so that everyone can have access to those and we can avoid the access barriers. So let me pause there. I'll stop sharing my screen and I'll yield my time.
Thank you for your presentation, Ms. Mathers. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Mathers? Representative Andrade.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. The one question I had was related to the job offers and lists of barriers to credential attainment, and then going back to the slide right before it. I'm just soft-spoken, I apologize. So when you're looking at the job offers barrier to attainment, I would venture to guess that most people on this committee would consider someone finding a job in the desired field a success. And just looking back to the previous slide on the funding model, about 30% between completion and certification are related to hopefully placing somebody in that degree field. Are there any examples around the country of a state that's accommodated for that one barrier to certification as an alternative to consider success or provide that certification?
I think it's certainly a win to your point that someone leaves a program to get a good job, right? That's where we want them landing. Hopefully a number of employers will continue supporting those individuals and help them earn the credential that goes along with the job that they're doing. In terms of accommodating for that within I want to make sure I understand your question correctly. Are you asking about accommodating for that within a funding model?
Yes, ma'am. So accommodating for that in essentially the Ohio higher ed performance standards, that organization providing that education has achieved that goal. And I just wanted to make sure they wouldn't somehow be penalized for someone leaving early to go take that job in that desired profession.
Yeah. Thank you for the clarification. So they get credit for the full-time students who have made it at least halfway through the program. So that's where they're taking it into consideration. They still get credit for those programs, students making it halfway through the program. And then 50% of that model is that they got a job. So they're getting full credit there. Where they're getting less funding is on the completion rate. So what I would suggest to you is that perhaps you look at that as a straw man. I don't think anyone necessarily has this just exactly right. But it's always good to look at those examples and see how other states have approached this, what's working, what's not working within their models. And I'm sure they will be making adjustments over time based on what their unique context and circumstances are as well.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Ms. Matthews, for your presentation. I have a question relating to the support system that is needed in order for the people to succeed. You mentioned three of the policy incentives. One was financial accountability and communication. As well, when I'm looking at the barriers to credential attainment, I saw the cost of education, job offers, lack of understanding, and also lack of access. I'm not seeing anything as far as the support system that is needed in order for them to succeed. And we know how critical that is, especially taking in the case of a single mother, for example. They might need the childcare. They might need some other support system in order to thrive and survive and be able to complete, you know, the credentials. So where do you put that into place? Where do you factor that into the whole equation?
I think that's an excellent point. I think we know that support services are critical. We know that advising is needed. We know that wraparound services, childcare, transportation, all of those factor into whether or not someone is able to enroll in, persist through, and complete a program. And we could probably do a whole webinar just on those pieces. I think you're making an incredibly important point. So, you know, whether you would classify those as incentives or whether you would call that out as a particular emphasis on support systems, they're certainly equally important. And I think that my colleague Mike will probably be speaking about that a little bit in terms of the work that they've done. Yeah, I'm getting a head nod there. Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Mathers, I have a question. So on your Virginia, on the Virginia's Fast Forward program, it says that a lot of those credentialing opportunities are 6 to 12 week programs. Is that unique to the Virginia model, or is that something in your research that is maybe in different states? And can you speak to that a little bit for me, please?
It's not terribly unique. These are non-credit workforce training programs. And they're designed to get folks quickly through a program and into a job. So especially at this moment in time when we see so many displaced workers across the country, we have a lot of rapid response efforts. Washington has their, I think they call it ECO-RICO, for example, economic recovery. Indiana, as Quentin mentioned earlier, has a rapid response system. Tennessee has a Reconnect program. They're all aimed at that one goal of, we have a lot of people who were quickly out of work. The industry that they were in is perhaps not rebounding quickly or may not rebound at all. What can we do to help get them back into a job, upskilled, trained quickly, and into employment? So 6 to 12 weeks seems to be a pretty good target there. So I don't think it's unique to Virginia, but an indication of how hard we're working across the country to get people quickly back to work.
Thank you for your response. Members, are there any other questions? Representative Valdez.
Thank you very much, Chair McClain. And to Chair McClain's question, can you give me an example of such program of one of these 40 highest demands fields that you're talking about in Virginia?
Well, Virginia's Fast Forward program is based on their 40 highest demand fields. So they're using a lot of labor market information to look at so different job services, for example, MZ, Burning Glass, JobsEQ, that scrape all the job ads that are out there, and they aggregate that information to say, where are all the opportunities? And then Virginia looks at that list and sort of ranks it and says, what are the top 40? Because what we wanna do is aim people towards the types of jobs where there's a lot of them. We want them to have a great opportunity to land in a job. We don't wanna put them into a job where there's not much opportunity. So they use that ranking system to say, these are the eligible areas for this particular program where we feel like folks have the best chance of getting a good job.
May I have a follow-up, sir? Quick one. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm looking for a real life example. I understand the process that they go through to try and get those 40 highest demand fields. Can you give me a current example? If I were to right now relocate to Virginia and I'm jobless and I can't find a job and I were to go to fast forward, what would I have an opportunity to do in Virginia?
Sure. There are a number of different fields. So IT, healthcare, advanced manufacturing all jump up to the top of the list. Within healthcare, if you'll go to any of the fast forward websites, you'll see like a certified nursing assistant is on the list, or a phlebotomist is on the list, a medical assistant. There will be a list of eligible programs and it will tell you exactly what the cost will be to you and how long it will take you to go through and what the corresponding certification is that you'll be earning. They also have the career coach work with you to help kind of narrow down what your choices are, what you're interested in, what's the best fit for you, so that you can enroll in a program where you have the greatest interest and aptitude and hopefully highest chance of completing.
Thank you.
Members, are there any other questions for Ms. Mathers? All right. Seeing none. Ms. Mathers, thank you again for your presentation this afternoon. We appreciate you joining us. We'll move on to
Thank you.
We'll move on to our third presenter this afternoon, and that will be Mr. Mike Reeser. He's the Chancellor and CEO of Texas State Technical College. Chancellor Reeser will discuss the impetus for their outcomes-based funding model, how the model works, and the results since implementation. Chancellor Reeser, you are recognized, and thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's indeed an honor to testify in front of you today. Although I'm speaking to you from Texas, where I've lived most of my adult life, my father was a native Floridian, and his family for generations lived and grew up there. And so I feel like I'm talking to my home state, and that adds to the honor. Today, what I'd like to share with you is a slightly different perspective. What you'll hear is an institutional perspective regarding outcomes-based funding. Both Quentin and Kathleen have provided some outstanding policy level looks. Now I'll share with you what it's like from an institutional perspective to actually follow an outcomes-based funding model. First, I'll tell you just a little bit about TSDC, maybe just a minute or two. Then I'll go straight to what I think you're interested in, which is our outcomes-based formula. And then finally, I'll share with you some lessons learned, some outcomes, some benefits and drawbacks of adopting this sort of approach. And then I hope there'll be plenty of time for questions after that. I will tell you that two of the final questions that y'all have already asked, you'll see that our method actually incents us to care about those sorts of challenges. So if I could, I will share my screen. Let's see here. I hope you see it.
Not yet.
Okay. Allow me to try once again. Share. Preview. There we go.
There we go. Thank you. Yep.
Okay. So there's my title screen. TSTC, Texas State Technical College, is the technical college system in Texas. And before I go on, let me say this. This PowerPoint presentation was designed to be something of a standalone document. So my oral comments will provide some color commentary, but the document itself, you could share with colleagues or use it as a discussion vehicle later on if you like, because we've tried to make it self-sufficient. So we're the two-year college system in Texas. We complement the comprehensive community colleges with a very narrow mission. We are tasked with focusing on the high demand and high tech workforce needs of Texas employers, and not to be a comprehensive community college. So we offer associate's degrees and all sorts of sub-associate credentials. Community College Weekly typically ranks us either number one or in the top three in terms of producing engineering-related associate degrees. And the thing that really sets us apart are these two features. We're paid our state funding based solely on the employment results of our students. We get no other funding other than some infrastructure funding. And I'll go into that more. And then the second is, we're the only college we found, public institution in America, that offers a money-back guarantee to students. And in that guarantee, I'll share you some more about that if I could. So here's an example of some of the programs we have. This is not all of them, but it is most of them. We have others that are sub-programs to these. If you'll take a quick look at them and you'll think about your knowledge of the economy in America today, you'll see that these are focused almost exclusively on really high-value, high-demand fields. And the reason is because of our outcomes-based funding model. So we'll get into that. In Texas, all education funding could be simplified into a two-variable system. That is an activity variable and a funding rate. And it doesn't matter if it's K-12 or graduate school or any other institution. The activity variable tends to be some sort of academic unit, say a contact hour or a credit hour. In the K-12 world in Texas, it's the average daily census times a funding rate equals the state funding. So in Texas, we refer to that as our formula funding. TSDC was under formula funding for 50 years of its initial existence until about 10 years ago when we got and willingly change to an outcomes-based method. This outcomes-based method is a two-variable system too, only in place of an academic activity variable, what we use for TSDC is an employment results variable times a funding rate equals our state funding. Now, an important distinction I have to draw right here is in the contact hour or the census model, that model is based on the assumption that education is a good thing. And we agree. And that assumption also leads to the notion that if it's a good thing, then more education is better. And so this cost recovery system is used by Texas, and it pays schools for the process of teaching. Now, that issue, though, in our rapidly changing economy is a notion you've seen in some of the previous two policy discussions, and that is there is a growing concern about the fact that a lot of education doesn't automatically lead to a great job. And so states find themselves paying for education, but not paying for employment. And so our approach switches all that. In a method that's used for TSDC, when employability is the sole activity variable, this method is blind to these factors. It's blind to how long it takes TSDC to train somebody. It's blind to what our overall enrollment is. It's blind to all of the various traditional ways of measuring academic success. In fact, credential completion, it's completely blind to that. All it pays for is putting a person to work in a great paying job. A good way to think about it is we're paid a commission to place people in a great job. And the more they make, the more the state funds us. So in the old system, we were paid by the hour to be busy teaching. In this new system, we're paid a commission based on putting Texans into a great job. And the amount of time that those Texans are measured is the first 5 years of their employment. So this method also incents us to have a high quality program that's focused on the need of the employers, or our students won't endure for 5 years and won't reflect positively in the formula. So that in a nutshell is how the formula works. Here's some of the advantages of this really innovative approach. The first is this, is that the state of Texas doesn't pay TSTC a nickel until we've actually put somebody to work. That means that TSTC is really, really concerned about things like students persevering through their studies. Because if a student comes and then leaves without getting a good job, all of the work we put into that student is for naught and doesn't, and we don't get paid for. So that's an advantage of it. Another is that the state need not pay TSTC until after those results are achieved. In the previous method, the state paid us for academic activity in a sort of speculative way. The hope was we were giving them the right credential and that credential will then hopefully lead to a good job. So it was a pro forma type of funding. Today, we're paid after the results are achieved, and that also means that it's a self-funding system. Our graduates are in the job for 5 years, and the Texas economy has seen the benefit of their employment, and then the state funds us. So the money's already in the treasury. Probably the most important thing about this approach is the way that everyone's self-best interests get aligned with this system. When we were paid on the academic unit, there was an economic incentive for us to get as many kids as we could into the system, keep them in the classroom as long as we possibly could, because the more we left them in the classroom, the more tuition we got and the more state funding we got. Well, but what the students are actually seeking is fast into college, fast through their course of study, and quickly to a job. That's what they're looking for when they come to us in the first place. And so under the old system, our best interests and theirs were out of alignment. Today, we want exactly what the student wants. And that is, we want them to get in, get through the studies that are required to get a great job, and then get them placed in that great job as quickly as possible. And so our best financial interests are aligned perfectly with those of the student. And when those are aligned, then they're also aligned with the best interest of the state and the taxpayers who foot the bill. So it makes us really, really concerned about having market driven programmatic mix. And finally, from a legislator standpoint, this is a big deal too. The risk of our performance, of whether we fulfill our mission, has been transferred under this system from the legislature, who is speculatively funding us in the old system, to the agency, who now has their well-being on the line. And the performance is, we're obligated to perform or starve. So what did that do to us? I've talked so far about money, but the real impact to this institution has been cultural. And this is an example of how culture has changed for us. I intentionally picked a scorecard. This is
Hey, members, while we got a minute here, why don't we take a few minutes? We didn't get to introduce ourselves. We haven't gotten to introduce ourselves at our meeting. So, Representative Robinson, if you just want to just give us your name, district, and what counties you cover, how about that? And that'll, we'll, till we can get this maybe up and running.
Representative Felicia Robinson, I represent House District 102, which covers North Miami-Dade County and South Broward. Three municipalities, parts of Pembroke Pines, Miramar, and Miami Gardens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marie Woodson, and I proudly represent District 101 in South Broward, which encompasses part of Hollywood, Pembroke Pines, Miramar, West Park, and Pembroke Park. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe Harding, I represent House District 22, which is part of Marion County and all of Levy County in an area that I like to refer to as God's country.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jason Chove. Represent House District 7. Consists of Lafayette, Taylor, Madison, Jefferson, Liberty, Leon, Calhoun, Wakulla, Gulf, and Franklin County.
I'm Representative Stan McClain. I represent House District 23, which is only half of Marion County. See, they knew my limitations, and obviously my vice chairman, they have a lot of confidence in him. He can cover multiple counties, but great to have all y'all here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm honored to represent the very great people of the 109th District in Miami, Florida, which encompasses Brownsville, Liberty City, Overtown, Attleboro, Wynwood, Melrose, Opa-locka, and the great people of Miami Gardens. And they need a blessing. Thank you.
And God willing, I've come to be that blessing. I'm Christopher Benjamin. I represent the good people of District 107, which encompasses Miami Gardens, North Miami, and North Miami Beach, unincorporated areas of Golden Glades and Ojas. So, from the north end of Miami-Dade County, greetings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Borrero, represent House District 105, which includes Miami-Dade County, Collier County, parts of Broward County, and Miramar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative Anika Umfroy, and I represent House District 95, like 95 South. I consider my district the heart of Broward County. It includes North Lauderdale, Tamarack, Sunrise, Margate, Plantation, Lauderdale Lakes, and Lauderhill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I am Susan Valdez, proudly representing District 62, which is the home of the Stanley Cup champions, the Tampa Bay Lightning, also home of the Tampa Bay Rays, also the Rowdies, and of course, this coming Sunday, the Buccaneers. So go Bucks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex Rizzo representing House District 110 in the northwest corner of Miami-Dade County. And it represents the central part of Hialeah, the east part of the Miami Lakes, and a portion of unincorporated Miami-Dade known as the Country Club of Miami.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jason Fisher, State Representative from House District 16, which is the southern portion of Jacksonville, and excited to serve on this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kaylee Tuck, District 55. I don't have as much as Representative Shove, but I have Highlands, Glades, Okeechobee, and a little bit of St. Lucie County as well. So thank you all so much. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Chair. Mike Gilombardo, District 77, Lee County. I just got one county and one city, Cape Coral. That's it. Really simple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Clay Yarbrough from House District 12 in Jacksonville. The district's all within Duval County, and happy to serve on this committee with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Randy Maggard, District 38, East Pasco, and apparently Representative Harding must not understand. He must have the second home from God because we had the first one. So, look forward to serving with you on this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Pat Maney, House District 4, the new Mel Ponder. I'm privileged to represent part of one county, Okaloosa County in the far western panhandle, the western gate of the Sunshine State, where thousands live like millions would like to.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Alex Andrade. I'm from a little bit farther west than even that, the city of Pensacola, representing House District 2. Thank you.
Well, thank you, members, for that taking up that amount of time. So we're still working on this. So it's going to take 2 minutes, so I'm going to do a song and dance while we're waiting. You're free to, you can take off your seatbelts. You're free to move about the cabin for a few minutes. Yeah. Members, will you take your seats, please? Chancellor Reeser, can you hear us now?
Yes, sir, Mr. Okay. Chairman, I can.
Great. I apologize. We had some technical difficulties on this end. We dropped off at the scorecard, and my members are really interested in the scorecard. So we didn't see anything that you said from scorecard on.
Oh, well, Mr. Chairman, I'm thankful to know it was a technical difficulty. I found myself talking to just space, and I thought it was something I had said.
No. In fact, I had a conversation with all the members here, very interested in your next part, which was the scorecard. There's a lot of interest. So go ahead. And it's about 20 till 6, and we'll let you roll as long as you can.
So if you'll bear with me as I find my way back to the sharing apparatus, if we can. Here, I'll get rid of this screen. Join you here.
Hey, share. If it makes it easier, we all have presentation slides in our folders. It's okay. We're good. Okay. Yes, sir. It's all good.
Are you seeing it now?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. There we go. So I was back. You missed the best. Was it this scorecard or the next one?
That one. Yes, sir. That one.
Okay. This is the programmatic scorecard, a scatter plot that shows the various programs at TSTC. The further to the upper right that a program gets, the more robust that it is. Likewise, the lower left quadrant are those that underperform all the rest. I picked this slide from August 17 because soon thereafter, those programs you see in the lower quadrant began to get sunsetted by TSTC. The reason we phased them out was students who signed up for those programs weren't seeing the employment outcomes that the other programs had to offer. So we were able to take our capacity in the form of manpower and money and redeploy from low-performing programs to high-performing programs. It's this process that allows us to do the money-back guarantee because we can offer, and the way that works is students who sign up for the money back guarantee programs, and there are six of them now, but more on the way. Those students who sign up for those programs, if they don't get a good job within 6 months of graduation, we refund 100% of their tuition. We've been doing that program for 3 years now. And of the thousands of students that we put to work, we've only had to issue one refund under that. The reason is this program incents us to focus on those jobs that are most needed by the state's employers. So the next scorecard is a programmatic scorecard. This is this one, for example, is diesel equipment technology. It allows the faculty within a program to see how they're doing longitudinally, you know, year over year, but it also allows them comparative analysis. And since these are published publicly, all of the programs know where they stand in terms of their performance within the program mix that TSTC offers to its students. So if a program is struggling in a particular area, this scorecard will help the faculty find their areas of struggle. And in addition to this, we provided them with essentially business consultants who help them assess their weak spots and fix them so that they can improve their scores on the scorecard. So when you pay for academic activities, you get a lot of academic activities. We know because we got pretty good at maximizing those, but when you pay for results, you get more results. These are actual data from TSTC over the past 10 years, and it was in the 2009 legislative session that we were challenged by the legislature to consider outcomes-based funding. We jumped whole hog into it over the next 2 years, and 100% of our formula funding is based on employment outcomes. So you can see the natural growth that we saw in our outputs. And the reason is we wanted to earn more money. And the way to earn more money is to realize bigger results for our students. Here's another thing, too, that one of you asked about, and that was the notion of helping students complete. You know, if we have students come to us and leave, then we don't get paid. So what we want is students to complete, and it's this growth curve was made possible in part two because we installed a culture of caring in our student services group that helped students, that provided a greater level of help for students who needed a greater level of help, particularly for those who were challenged by, not by the academic endeavors, but by life itself. And so part of this outcome is because this approach has got us really focused on students getting into the great jobs. And to do that, they have to complete. So what does it mean then for us to do this, to grow our outcomes? Well, the first thing that's most important is that we learned is you have to start with the end in mind, an old Stephen Covey saying, and that is we retooled every program we had, not based on what faculty thought that industry wanted, but based on a thorough understanding of what the jobs are in our state and what sorts of skills, not credentials, not classes, but skills the employers needed in order to reach that kind of job. And so we start with the end in mind. We teach right-sized programs. It's a waste of everybody's time and money if we teach someone too long. All you're doing is delaying their entry into the workplace. So some of our programs got shorter. Most of our programs got shorter under this system. Some grew slightly. We target the high demand needs. You know, there's been a lot of talk on your testimony today about identifying the high value stuff. If you pay a school for results, the school will figure out where the high value is. And that's exactly what we've done. In fact, first thing we did was go hire a workforce economist to help us answer those questions. We run like a for-profit business today, and the reason is every dollar in taxpayer money we spend, if we don't get a good return on investment for that dollar, then we are hurting our capability to help more students get great paying jobs. So we measure the ROI on everything. And backroom functions that are nice to have but not necessary went away quickly under this new program. We do program sorting on an annual basis. We rank them. We invest in those that do well, and we phase out those that don't. And we gave faculty the power to adapt their programs so that they could optimize the student success at the end. So, and then finally, some of the lessons learned. One of the most common question that I get when I present this, the nature of this, is why don't we fund all of higher ed this way? And what I'll say is this: higher ed is made up of a wide array of institutions who serve a wide array of purposes. For TSTC, we had one narrow purpose and one purpose only: create a skilled technical workforce for the high need job or the high demand jobs of Texas. So employment outcomes were the right metric to tie our funding to. If I were a comprehensive university, I would have more missions than just putting people to work. I'd have research, and I would have cultural impact, and I would have other less tangible missions that I'm expected to fulfill. My point is, if you consider outcomes funding, I urge you to consider this: pick your metrics carefully, because the organization will organically and naturally focus its attention on realizing where those resources come from. That's the benefit you're seeking in the first place. So be careful what you measure, because that's what the organization will follow. Second lesson was, and you've already heard that, you heard Kathleen talk about this: make sure you calibrate, or you create a transition zone for an institution to go from a pay for activity to pay for outcomes, because it won't be a smooth transition. There'll be a few bumps in the road. So help calibrate the funding of the new with the old. The next, which is very, very cultural in nature, this was not popular with everyone at TSDC. There were a lot of folks who didn't like the fact that we were changing the way that we measure success because of the traditional practices of the academic academy. The academic academy is about knowledge and scholarship, not workforce prep. And so we lost people. We had folks who said, I'm not going to be part of a college that operates that way. We gave them a hug and we sent them out the door and we said, thank you very much. But what we replaced that attitude with was a version of student success that is indisputable. A fabulous job is an indisputable proof that you have fulfilled your role as a college. And that's what we took on. It takes time to do this. And the final lesson we learned is this: don't do this to a college that doesn't have a board and an on-site management team that is absolutely committed to the process, because it took an extraordinary amount of care, leadership, nurturing, and frankly, in some cases, pushing to get the conversion done. But today, TSTC is a mature, outcomes-based entrepreneurial institution who sees that by realizing true student success in the workplace, we can earn more money to do a bigger and bigger job every day. So that concludes my comments, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Chancellor Reeser. Members, before we start asking questions, let me recognize Representative Andrade for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move we extend by 15 minutes.
Is there any objection? We will extend to 6:15. Members, obviously we've got about 20 minutes. I think we may have a fair amount of questions. Try to be as concise as possible. And Chancellor Reeser, you're welcome. When a question is answered, you don't have to go through the chair. You can just answer the questions directly. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized.
You mentioned that there was some resistance from faculty when you rolled out this program. And I was interested to know, was there a union, and what was, if there was, what was the union's response to this?
No, sir. The TSTC is not organized. There was no union, but there was a faculty senate that in part played a role similar to a union. What we did is we sat down with Faculty Senate and we explained, look, here's where we're going, why we're going there, and why it's better for the college, for the students, and for you, the faculty. And they listened. And although we had some turnover, I would say it was probably 10%, maybe 15 over 5 or 6 years. The spirit of collaboration built over time, and we were finally able to achieve where we are now, which is a unified institution. So I want to say it was manageable. We got through it. But I didn't want to gloss over the fact that there are some people who couldn't bring themselves to imagine a college different than it had always been before. And so we lost some talent.
Chair.
Rep. Valdez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeser, thank you so much for your presentation. I was really enjoying it, and then it just went on a blink. So it's like, oh, my God, what happened? So I'm glad we were able to get you back. My question is, do you have any articulation agreements? Does the college have any articulation agreements with the school district for their seniors or juniors?
We do dual credit at about 90 different high schools across the state. All of the dual credit we do is technical in nature. And all of it is designed to result in some sort of industry certificate. It also then articulates up to a college credential with us. But I will point out that dual credit, although a very small part of our business, is the one exception to the outcomes-based funding. We're paid by the contact out of that. It makes up less than 1% of our funding, so it's not a big part. In terms of articulation, we also have up relations with universities. For example, our pilot training program, we have several of the universities in Texas that we articulate with for the students who come to us to learn to fly and then continue their studies at the university so they can be an airline pilot. We have articulation agreements in both directions.
Representative Robinson, recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Question, well, I actually have two-part question. I was trying to find out, how are the students paying for this? Are they paying completely pocket? I know in one of the other events they talked about a third from the students and a part Kent State. Is this, you know, having financial aid come up? And if it doesn't, what is the incentive to actually get them to enroll?
Yes, ma'am. Well, first, let me answer yours first. The incentive to enroll at TSTC, it hardly doesn't matter which program you pick. You can just about be good. There's going to be a great job at the end of your studies. We don't sell college. We sell a prosperous career. College is a means to that end. So, we're accredited by SAC COC, which is the same regional accredit that accredits all of the schools in Florida. Our students are eligible for federal financial aid. However, tuition is modestly priced. It is very similar to the community college tuitions in Texas, which are extremely affordable. In terms of affordability, this is among the best, the top 10 in terms of student affordability. So for those who do have to borrow money from the federal financial aid system, we are also the top school, two-year school in Texas in terms of the ratio of starting salaries versus student loan debt. And a typical student leaves here less than earnings of our
averaging exceed their student limit by 1.5%, 1.5 times. And let's say it a different way. A typical student who borrows money, if they did 100% of their first year earnings to student repayment, the average student can pay it off in 8 months. That's the of their outstanding earnings to the modest student loan debt. Did that
charge? Thank you, President Harding.
I enjoyed that. A lot to take away there. On the outcome-based funding, one of the slides, the 2017 slide that you showed, and we see the parts below the line that weren't up to snuff. What was savings at the state that you had a measurable? Is that something that you are tracking as far as programs that may be eliminated that aren't successful? Do you put something that
It's for me, top of my head, to remember the amount recovered from the canceled program. There wasn't an actual savings. We took those and the head count that were in those canceled programs and redeployed them, the high-performing programs, and grew the high-performing programs. So what we did was take the entire money and apply it to higher-yielding opportunity. So we didn't actually return to the state, just did better outcomes.
Vice Chair Cho.
Thank you, Chair. Chancellor, states that use this commission-based system that you're aware of?
We are not aware of another country that does it like this.
Thanks, Chair. And perhaps you answered it, and I just didn't catch it. My good colleague, representative, asked about much as the cost of a student qualify for us, how much of this is offset by what the state is reimbursing, if you will, or giving back to the college?
So our annual budget is typically about $250 million. Out of $250 million, about somewhere between 45% and 50% of all of our expenses are paid for by our state funding. And then about somewhere between 20% and 25% of the budget is tuition paid by students. So a typical associate degree from TSTC in terms of tuition alone is going to cost a student somewhere between $6,000 to $8,000 for the 2-year program. I don't know what how much it costs students in Florida, but in terms of Texas, that is not unusual for a 2-year degree to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $6,000 to $8,000 for tuition. Now, if you add housing and all of those other things on top of it, then it can get up between $10,000 and $12,000 for an associate degree. And you can see why. I'll give you a perfect example. I'll pick up welding, for example. Welding graduate from TSTC is in the 50th in Texas. And so if he graduates with, say, $20,000 worth of debt and goes to work for a $50,000 a year job, you can see that the return on investment for that student was extraordinary. Our students tend to pay their student loan debt off in a few years as opposed to decades. And our student loan default rate is the lowest in Texas. Only the flagship universities have a better rate. And the reason is the ratio of student loan debt or the cost of attendance to the value of the jobs our students get is so good. Let me say it this way. In Texas, we have an old saying, it ain't bragging if it's true. I think we're the highest return on tuition investment that a student in Texas can find. For a dollar invested in college, it's hard to find a better job at the end of his studies.
Brett Rizzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chancellor, what is the average age of the typical student at your university or your college?
Last year is 28 years old. So what that meant is for every 18-year-old fresh high school graduate, we had a 38-year-old who was retooling his or her skills so that they could stop being unemployed or underemployed.
Brizzo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
First series.
Chancellor, what is the attrition rate of enrollees to complete coursework?
That's a trick question. And if you will, allow me to explain. When a college is teaching credentials, when they're selling credentials, then completion is a particularly thorny issue. But you heard Kathleen talk about something that happens around here all the time. In our welding program, we have employers who actually stock the parking lot because the talent is so desperately needed. They're ready to take someone before they actually complete their credential. So the direct answer to your question is we have the highest graduation rate of any two-year school in Texas. But in terms of people we place in a job, we place over 90% of our graduates in jobs, whether they complete or not.
Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chancellor, for such a great presentation. I would like to know, what was the driving force behind Texas State coming up with this model? Was it the brainchild of the workforce economists, or just things weren't working with the previous model?
TSTC is an unusual college in that most of its leadership team came out of industry and not out of the academy. So most of the leadership at TSTC has a market focus as their career tradition. We also have, because we come out of industry and not academics, we believe that higher ed is ripe for some innovation, that it's an industry too bound in convention and old notions of how it earns its keep. And we believe that deeply enough that when the legislature gave us an opportunity, we couldn't resist being a vanguard in what we believe is essentially a reform of the industry. It was a challenge that from a career standpoint, we just couldn't resist, and an opportunity to pay it forward to the students who are going to study here in the decades to come. So it was a mission driven by passion and a sense of righteous reform.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. Chancellor, I really am impressed with the presentation. Just wanted to ask about the ethnic diversity in the school. How is it, who all attend?
TSTC is representative of the state of Texas. We have roughly an equal population of white students and Hispanic students. We are technically a Hispanic-serving institution, and likewise, our African-American population is representative of the population in Texas. I will say, if we had a better job to do, it would be in gender. Many of our technologies are traditionally male-dominated, and we still have room to grow in terms of attracting more females into those male-dominated fields.
Yes.
The last time I saw, I think our ratio was 60-40. Yeah.
Representative Bush.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we have about 2 or 3 minutes. Okay. I'll conclude it this way. Mr. Chancellor, I'll just say what Ralph Waldo Emerson said in a lecture back in 1871. He said, if a man can write a better book, or preach a better sermon, or make a better mousetrap than his neighbor, even if he builds his house in the woods, the world will make a beaten path to his door. I just think, Mr. Chairman, that we need to put a delegation together and go to Texas and have an opportunity to observe this program, because this is the most progressive and complete innovative approach to education, because in two ways. It not only provides an educational opportunity, but also it provides a job opportunity. I have about 15 questions, but I'm just going to yield because of the time.
That's why he's my ranking member, because he's got the word, he's got the eloquence for us. Chancellor, I have a couple of questions. One, does the legislature then set a bucket of money? I mean, do you have a line item? And in other words, they set a bucket of money up, assuming that you're going to graduate X amount of students over, I guess they only meet every other year, so it'd be over a two-year period. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's a question? You're shaking, so that's a yes?
Yes, sir. I'll answer that. The formula funding in Texas is an allocation method and not a hardwired formula. However, TSTC is a tiny part of the overall higher ed budget in Texas, maybe 3%. And so funding and a growing body of members in Senate Finance and House Appropriations have come to support our outcome funding so aggressively that for the past few sessions, we've had no problems at all getting paid our entire earned amount. Another benefit the legislature has is because our students are measured in the workplace for 5 years, they know years ahead of time how much TSTC has already earned before they get reflected in the funding formula. So there's plenty of opportunity for the legislative budget staff to project what TSTC's funding will be.
Thank you. In 5 seconds or less, what's your commission on your earnings?
Is that a 36%? Yes. The total aggregate earnings of the students, mm-hmm. minus some discounting,
yes,
minus minimum wage, and then we get 36% of the added value, and the state gets the rest.
Very good. Chancellor Reeser, we're up against our time here. Thank you so much for your presentation. Obviously, a lot of members have. It was very good and very helpful for us as we move forward with some things that we're going to be doing here in the Florida legislature. And so we appreciate your time today. Members, thank you for your attention to this today. It was a great presentation. And without any ranking member Bush moves, we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.